Hello, would you please start by stating your full name, the date, the time, and your location?
My name is Elisa Petgrave Nelson. It is 12:03 p.m. in New York, in Long Island, New York, and today is July 6, 2022.
And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under a Creative Commons license, attribution, non-commercial share alike?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Would you please start by introducing yourself to anyone who might find themselves listening? What would you want them to know about you and the place you're speaking from?
Sure. So I am an oncology social worker. I work with cancer patients in an outpatient cancer clinic and infusion center. I support family members, patients with just the various challenging situations that they encounter with a cancer diagnosis. And I've been doing this for about 15 years.
Would you tell me a story about your life during the pandemic?
So not only am I an oncology social worker, but I'm also an oncology social worker of color. I'm a Black woman of Jamaican descent. And the pandemic was, I'm sure, exhausting for everyone, but I think it was more so quite, trying for people of color and especially essential workers of color, which is, the title that we were given working in a hospital or a healthcare setting. But it was very overwhelming. Just being here with all of the injustices. There were in March of 2022, when the World Health Organization declared that we were officially a pandemic. Things just changed. It was a quite a just a very sh large shift compared to how we were getting along. I think even racially, based on the political climate that was happening at that time. And then around May, especially with the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, excuse me. So that led to a lot of just a lot of collective grief amongst my my the few Black colleagues that are here, and also with our oncology patients of color, and also our patients of non, that were our white patients, right? They were really struggling with all of everything that was going on. And I think that it was quite exhausting for myself, being one of the few people of color here. When you're seeing, a Black person with a knee on their neck screaming for their deceased mother, that caused a lot of pain, grief, loss, sorrow. And so, I had to not only deal with my own feelings as a woman of color, married to a Black man, raising a Black son, but also, supporting the staff members that were here, who really couldn't, they didn't have the privilege to grieve and to deal with, or to openly grieve in a setting that it's primarily white. And unfortunately, in the, in the setting they were, that they were in at that time, that we were in at that time, some of the, some of our workers had a lot of the sentiments that were, in that were in the political climate of Make America Great Again and wanting to return to some of those those values, right? And so that was quite trying, and having to support not only my family, emotionally be there, for myself. And to also support our few Black staff members and our patients that were going through it, who couldn't really talk about it openly. The white patients who were really, really concerned and were just, just very upset and saddened by all that was going on. And also some of our white staff members who came to me in confidence and were quite upset about what was going on, and, asking about how to speak to their families. How can, a lot of the terms included, like, allies, how can they be an ally? So those are just a few of the things that went on.
What was it like having to support so many people with so many different needs around that at the moment, including yourself?
It was horrible. It was daunting. It was, I think my days were spent, well, first off, I think that, on March 23rd, I was home with COVID. And again, this is like new, we didn't really know what was happening. Things were changing in the clinic. And I recall just, looking at myself, washing my hands, getting ready to leave at 4 o'clock. And I looked at myself and thought, oh my gosh, you don't really look too good. And by the time I went home, my husband had called a physician and he said, we're just, obviously we couldn't go into the office and the doctor's office or a city MD or any type of, outpatient setting. They were just like, just stay home and just operate like you had this, you have this virus. And so it was very scary. And for the next 3 weeks, I spent, my husband and I were quite ill and so much so that I thought I was dying. We had our will next to us. We had teenage children and we were just like, in case something should happen, these are the things that we have set in place for you guys if something happens. But that was the only time that I had off those 3 weeks when I returned back to work in April after having COVID and having long-term effects of just, no taste, just this chronic fatigue and just feeling all of that. And in addition to, as I mentioned, all of the political things and just faces of Black people who are being killed, it was very exhausting coming back to a hospital setting and having to be there emotionally because I was still trying to figure out, oh my gosh, will I be, the trauma of having COVID, saying, oh my gosh, I nearly died. Then coming back in like clinic and having to support all these different people, it was exhausting. It was scary. It was, you're kind of just existing, right? You're not living here. coming in daily, but just existing every day. I'd finish up here, go home and just lay on the sofa, in a state of depression, just sadness. Like you're there, you're co-piloting, you're making meals, you're taking showers, you're talking to your children and being, especially in my situation, being hyper vigilant with my family and just being careful. And, even though you live in a so-called quote unquote safe neighborhood, like, my son had just got his license. And as just a young Black kid, I had like all these cautionary tales and examples of what he needed to do. And, don't dress like this, don't wear that, don't, to make sure that he wasn't going to be, to make sure that he wasn't going to be pulled over or, just very fearful of that. And, just thinking back as I'm speaking, I think that at that time it was just such a sense of fear, and just not wanting just something that should have been such a great, rite of passage. Everyone, you get your license, you feel so happy. But I think it was the opposite, it was quite the opposite for myself being, a Black mother, a Black woman during that time. So it was just overwhelming altogether and just exhausting and, just scary.
What are some of the ways that the support you were offering looked like? What were the kinds of things you were doing that was supportive?
So, in reference to my family, it was more of like, just we were having more meals together. We try to focus on that piece, but like as far as family support, just being there, we were doing like online, church services, and our faith is quite important to us. So we did a lot of that, a lot of just, sitting outside and just being in nature, just doing more of those self-care things, just kind of being together as a family, checking in with people, checking with family members from Jamaica, from other, just trying to stay close with people, even though we could not, physically be together. In reference to like colleagues, I think that the support to them, and it was vice versa. I think it was reciprocated from some of my colleagues who had the bandwidth, the emotional bandwidth to deal with it. And some didn't. They couldn't provide any support to me, which was quite frustrating because I'm usually the strong one. And so, that wasn't reciprocated from some people. But for myself, with my colleagues, it really meant just providing emotional support to each other, to, including our patients too, the emotional support, just trying to be, active listening, validating their responses to some of the fears that they were feeling too, white and black patients. Just trying to figure out like, oh my gosh, will this be the end of this? How can they, sharing coping strategies, how to deal with people and their family members or friends or colleagues, that were also on the Make America Great Again rant or ideologies. And so, supporting those patients and trying to help them to deal with, losing their family members, not only to COVID physically, but also a lot of my patients, they were so upset about the political climate and what some of their family members were saying, about Hispanic people, Black people. And so that caused a lot of strife and dissension in families. And so they were upset. And I mean, parents were not speaking to their children. Children were not speaking to their parents. People were being written off because of their political beliefs. And so that trickled down to, more distress and on the cancer journey. So it was a lot of just, supporting that and helping them to cope and to deal with that and to find ways to deal with the isolation and the sadness and the fear and, then the deaths of their family members, whether it's making referrals to outside organizations, outside therapists. And also I saw an uptick in the amount of patients that I was seeing individually, because sometimes you couldn't even really sit in the infusion center to have these conversations. So I was meeting more on one-to-one with those oncology patients who are really struggling. So overall, we were all trying to, support and to just give each other the emotional support and guidance that we needed.
Would you help me understand how your role as a social worker in this space ties to the emotional support you were giving? Is that emotional support something that was a part of your work, or was it something extending beyond that purview?
Yeah, we do provide emotional support to, cancer patients and their families. That definitely is a role that oncology social workers or social workers, dealing with when whatever setting you're in, that emotional support is a part of that. But I think that it became more, it was more needed. It was more like on a day-to-day, yes, we're giving that reassurance, we're giving that support. But I think that as COVID, during COVID, the need for more emotional support, it became more involved, it became longer. If you're providing counseling to patients, it means that you have to give them more of your time instead of, 20 minutes or, it's now turned into like a half hour of crying and tears and, and just adding to more talk time for the provider and more time with the patient. So then you're kind of like backed up with your other things that you're doing. So, it was kind of like a domino effect, but that piece was, it is a part of it that we, a part of our role, but I think that it became a broader part or practice of our role and required more time.
Would you tell me a little bit about how your day-to-day was looking pre-COVID?
So my day-to-day in the clinic included or entailed coming to the clinic, going to rounds in the morning. You not only are we following the physicians in the office and the oncology office where patients come to get diagnosed and to discuss their treatment options and treatment regimen, when will they start. Not only that, we also follow the physicians in the infusion center. So in total, we have six doctors, oncology, hematology doctors, solid tumors, breast, and then we also, breast, everything, lung, gastric, everything. And blood cancers too. So what we would do is we'd come in the mornings at 8 and we'll have rounds and just to kind of discuss new patients and patients who are returning, talk about their diagnosis. And, we have meetings, various meetings throughout the day. We have support groups in the evenings throughout the day, paint sessions from various grants, our staff meetings, following up with grant writers to support grant funding for some of these programs that we have, making referrals for patients, speaking with patients, seeing all of our new patients, making hospice referrals, having our IDT meetings, our interdisciplinary meetings with, whether it's palliative care, whether it's nursing, our pharmacists, having, our support services, to have people come in to give us education on certain resources in the community that are available to our patients. So our day entailed, it's a full 8 hours of working and following up with patients, our administrators, doctors, making referrals to various institutions, following up with the inpatient social workers, to find out what's going on with our clinics. Our patients who are admitted to the hospital, they get ill sometimes, and so they have to go over to the main hospital. So it involves all of that.
Is there anything you're willing to share about what it was like to have COVID and how you took care of yourself during that period of time?
I think the main thing with COVID was just the fear. I think now, 2 years later, I see people, they get COVID now and it's like, oh yeah, we're home for 5 days. It's kind of like a little reprieve, right? We're able to, from what I hear anyway, it's like, yeah, we got, I have COVID, but no, I had a mild cough. It seems more, like it's allergies. And this, when I had it, was pre-vaccine. So there was a lot of fear. I mean, there were, especially here on Long Island, you'd hear, super spread up parties or people were, I remember hearing the first time, I think it was a family in Long Island that had 11 family members who passed away. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, like how do you bury 11 people at the same time? Like, you think about the cost of it, the emotional toll, and even for people who probably didn't even, at that time, I think some of the people who passed away, whether they were agreeable to getting, to having a cremation, they weren't able to have nothing else outside of that. You think about New York where, we were in the epicenter of it. So it was a lot of fear. And for me having it, a lot of the responses of my husband and I was just like, oh my gosh, could we be one of these people, one of these family members where our children are burying both of us? Or, I recall seeing on the news with the buzzards flying over New York City, and which is totally like, it's not something that you see here in New York, but, bodies, human beings were like in, trucks trying to preserve their bodies until they were able to be buried or cremated. So it was a lot of fear. And as I said, it was before the vaccine. So, just not being able to know like what would be the outcome of this. I think I recall as soon as I recovered, and it took a couple of months, I had like 5 months of not being able to taste salt, sweet, I was someone who was able to walk 3 miles easily. And I couldn't even walk like, 500 feet without being winded. And I'm a so-called healthy person, so it was a fear of like, at that moment, oh my gosh, will I die? oh my gosh, will I be able, do my lung has my, my do my lungs have scarring? Will I be able to function the way that I used to? And it also opened up my eyes too, as far as how our oncology patients felt. And it kind of put me in their, you know, in their shoes a little bit, for me to understand what it was like for them to not have the ability to get up and to do things. Like for a young woman, you know, for myself, to lay there on the sofa and wanting to get up to make a cup of tea, and I could not because I had no energy. You know, I think about all of those patients who have had, you know, who have chemo, and they're totally unable to get up to make themselves a cup of tea. They can't take a shower. They can't, you know, can't be a mother or father to their child or children. So it really opened up my eyes to a lot of just those feelings and just those experiences that our patients had and have.
When you realized you were getting sick and that it was serious, how did you talk to your husband and son about it?
I think, like, when we came home, because I came home, my husband was on the phone on a Zoom call with the doctor. And then we were just like, and we have two children, we have a boy and a girl. And so we, I remember us being in the living room, and the doctor said to my husband, he said, you know, my husband, David, he said, you know, there's a, you know, she says she's not feeling too well. And my husband said, you know, my throat feels a little itchy. And he said, just operate like you guys have it. And I was just like, what do you mean? I feel fine, because it was 4 o'clock. It was a sunny day. It was in March. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, no, by the end of the night, you'll feel like you got hit by a bus. Excuse me. And I'm someone who comes home and, like, you know, wash hands, change clothes, make dinner. Like, I rest for a little bit, then I make dinner. And I remain on that couch. I think I had enough, because I change my clothes when I leave work. But I recall changing my clothes, and I laid on that sofa from like 5 o'clock after the phone call with the doctor till 12 o'clock. And he was right. You know, his words were quite prophetic, that I felt like a bus had hit me, and it just gradually became worse throughout the night. And we were just like, oh my God, like, what, you know, my husband and I think we kept our fear to ourselves at that time. But our children, we, you know, we had, thank goodness, we had two bathrooms. So, you know, the doctor was like, oh yeah, isolate, you know, and I remember thinking to myself, but how are other people able to isolate? Like, what if it's somebody in like a one family home, or what, you know, I thought about those things too. Like, how are other people able to do this? Because you can't see it. You're not sneezing. You're just like, it's just whatever it is. And so I was able to, you know, we spoke to our kids like across the hall, and was just like, you guys just stay in your room. We'll, you know, daddy and I are going to be over here, try to, you know, giving them instructions on how to wipe the place down with Lysol. You know, they'd go in the kitchen first and get something to eat. You know, family and friends were like driving to the house and leaving, like all of these holistic homemade remedies. I think being from the Caribbean, you know, there were a lot of talks about different teas and things to, you know, different vitamins to take. So some of our friends were calling, and even our parents, because, you know, our parents were calling, very worried, our siblings. And so they would, you know, my mom, they would like drop off fresh lemon or ginger and things like that by the door and just walk away, you know, and left it for us to, when we did have the strength, to get up and boil some of these herbal teas from scratch to try to get our strength back. But, you know, with, in regards to speaking to our children, I think we're pretty open parents. And so, you know, we were just like, listen, if something should happen, you know, the will is here. And, you know, we told our parents, you know, that our wills were by our bedside, and that, you know, if anything should happen, like, you know, it has, like, you know, what, who, you know, the kids would live with my mom in New York and maybe do summers and out of state with the, you know, my mother-in-law. Like, so we had all of those things set in place, and it was a difficult conversation to be had. And, you know, our kids, I mean, they're teenagers, so they were aware of existing wills and advanced directives. You know, I think our parents, of course, they were just like, oh no, you guys are going to pull through. But I think for us as parents, and the chills and the fevers and the, oh my gosh, the pain and just the, I mean, you felt like an elephant was on your chest and you can't breathe and you can't go to the hospital. You're just kind of just sink or swim.
I'm curious, what does the word health mean to you?
I'm sorry, repeat that.
What does the word health mean to you?
I think health means just a sense of well-being, emotionally, physically, spiritually, to be healthy. I think that's the only thing. You know, I think, you know, I say to everybody all the time, I go, you know, I don't pray for like money or riches or whatever. I just pray for health. Like, I just want to be healthy, you know, to be autonomous, to be able to get up and walk. I think we take those things for granted. So those are things that are healthy to me, to be able to, you know, get up and walk every day, to be able to see, to hear, to like touch things, like just to be able to be able to get around. I think those things are very important. We take them for granted. Just smelling, being able to smell, you know, and taste, is to be able to have a sense of well-being. That's health.
What do you think are some of the changes that we might need to make as a society to make that version of health available to, if not everyone, the majority of the population?
I think there needs to be so many changes, and unfortunately, I hope to be like, I'm not trying to be jaded, but I think that the way that the world is going right now, I don't think that there's going to be any resolution to health, physical, emotional. I think even now, you know, now especially 2 years later, post COVID, we're seeing so many just challenges, just, you know, with gun violence and crimes, like, and it's all causing us like physical, emotional, psychological, it's putting such a strain on us on all these levels. And so, you know, it would be great to be able to have, you know, without being too political, like having politicians who care about you, and, you know, to have the amount of funding to be able to you know, to do research and to stop all the sickness, and, you know, policing and, you know, having proper funding for certain things, whether it's community centers or schools, and, you know, and even for policing to make sure that, you know, police officers have what they need to support our communities, to like all those things. But I don't think that we will get to that place. Because there's just so much, I think that there's so many issues right now. It just seems I can't really think of anything right now, but I think it really depends on each individual, right? You have to try your best to find whatever peace or well-being, whatever health you can find for yourself, because you can't rely on others outside of your immediate space to, or your community per se, to help you with that. I think we had, you know, there are things there in the community that are supposed to do that, but as we can see for the last couple of months, especially, that some of those things are not even working, that we're, so it's difficult to try to find any, you know, those resolutions. And unfortunately, I don't know if there's anything in sight to rely on, you know, people to correct all these wrongs, because there's just so much involved. Politically, financially, yeah. So I hate to sound jaded, but that's the way that I see it.
What does the word safety mean to you?
Safety means, like, again, physical. When I think of safety, I think of physical, right? Physical well-being, being safe. I always, you know, not having an injury or, you know, somebody hurting you. You know, I think that for myself, like, I feel safe to a certain level, but not all the time. I think with COVID too, and with everything that's, you know, has went on, and now especially with all the increase, you know, shootings and just gun violence. You know, I was in the store the other day, and I was in Trader Joe's, and I thought for a moment, what if somebody started shooting right now? Like, what, you know, and I'm very conscious of that. I'm conscious of, you know, even at work, you know, if I'm cognizant of, like, if I, you know, to be aware of if there have any overhead messages, if I hear anything, if I hear any loud sounds in the hallways, even on the unit with patients, if a patient raised their voice or something, you're kind of, you know, for myself anyway, I'm kind of cognizant of, like, okay, where are the exits? If I go to restaurants, I'm very cognizant of, like, you know, how would I get out of here if something happened? If I'm in the supermarket, you know, being very much cognizant. So I think that safety, yes, you know, you want to be safe, or you want to prevent, you know, an injury to yourself. But do I feel fully safe? No, because I know that in an instant that could change. No matter, I could be at home, I could be in a car. So I try not to have those thoughts come in, but they're there, and they're, I think they're more evident now than they were prior to the pandemic, with everything, with the uptick of everything that has happened or continues to happen. And especially being in New York, you know, if I get on the train, I'm very cognizant of what's going to happen. You know, I have mace, like, I'm always, like, just very cognizant of, like, you know, in case, just in case, you know, so.
I'm wondering what kind of comparisons or differences you see in your experiences of hypervigilance.
Hypervigilance for me, it's like, just like that increase, like when I use it before, I was thinking of, like, my, you know, my son, and having to just to be even more aware, like this increased sense of awareness. I didn't have it, and I hope I'm answering this correctly. I didn't have it. I mean, I was cognizant of safety and all these different things prior, and just being around of my surroundings and being aware of, you know, different traumas and people dying, and, you know, I'm aware of all of that. But I think that once I started seeing it more on the television, you know, that it was very traumatic. So, like, that kind of led to me now being more, being more, like, having more of those intrusive thoughts, right? Like, or just that fear, like, oh my gosh, what if something should happen? If my son went out for a drive, I'd be like, oh my gosh, like, you know, I wouldn't feel comfortable until he got back home. Or just, you know, it was, so that's where I was with it then. And I'm still very conscious of it now, because again, even if you're going out, because of all the increased gun violence and all the other things that we're facing in our communities, even, I mean, I won't say post-COVID, we're still in, you know, we're still in a pandemic, but, is it as bad as it was back then, 2 years ago, the start of, or I would say May of 2020, because I use George Floyd as that kind of, like, that reckoning or that waking up of, you know, all these emotions and triggers. That was a big trigger for a lot of us. So I think, you know, it's still there, and I don't think it will dissipate, you know, because it's on to something else, you know? I hope I answered that correctly.
Your answer is perfect. Everything you offer is perfect. What was it like talking to your children about sort of the sort of constant influx of things happening over the last couple of years, COVID, George Floyd, other political events?
I think it was, I don't want to say it's easy. I think my husband and I, we're pretty open with our children. And I try to, you know, I think we're coming from the experience of knowing what it's like to be Black in America, right? Be Black in our neighborhoods. My husband was the first, like, one of the first people who moved into a town in Queens. And we're not old people, you know, we're like middle-aged. And I remember, you know, he moved into a town where they were like burning crosses because they didn't want any Black people to come into their neighborhood. So I think we've had those experiences. And even myself, being an immigrant here in America in the 80s, you know, and being told to go back to your country and, you know, all these derogatory statements and, you know, remembering, and I mean, my husband and I are like, we're not 60, we're not 50, you know, and to we've relayed our experiences with our children and let them know that, unfortunately, no matter what degree you get, no matter, you know, you could have MD behind your name, you could have a PhD, you could have whatever, you'll still be looked at as, you know, a nigger sometimes, you know, and that's what we were called, that's what we've been called. And I remember the first time that I was called that. And so I worried with my children what it was like, what it will be like, you know, and my husband, I've stayed up at night talking about this, like, what will it look like when our children are, you know, every Black person recalls the first time, they know the day, the time, what they were wearing, they remember when they're called that for the first time and those feelings and emotions that go with it, right? So all of that to say that we've been quite open with our children about what this life will be like for them, no matter how great our neighborhood is. And, you know, we're still the only Black people that live in the neighborhood. So it's like, you know, and our children, you know, my daughter came home from school, you know, being, you know, told that she was less than or a quarter of a person because of the color of her skin. So, you know, I think that there's no safe place except for our home and with us and talking to them and giving them these lessons and these, giving them these stories and giving them our experiences so that they'll know how to deal and cope with that and to know that, yes, Daddy and I have been through this. And, you know, and hearing stories from their grandparents and the sacrifices that they've had to make and things like that. So it wasn't difficult to have those conversations. I think they're kind of our topics. We're a pretty open family and they're topics that we have them come home and we talk about them. And, you know, they're not, you know, they're not secrets. They're not, it's not an off topic or fear of it. It's just to make sure, you know, we may feel, I think as parents, I feel, you know, anger sometimes if I hear of something happening, but I have to make, give them the education and give them the strategies to deal and to cope with these type of conversations and experiences. So it wasn't hard at all.
How do you think your children have been handling the pandemic?
I think at first it was scary. I think my son, who is at that time he was 18 in 2020, and you know, at first, you know, it was like a joke, like, "Oh, mommy, come on, COVID doesn't exist," you know, because he had all these, you know, these conspiracy theories and all these different things, and it was a joke. But I knew he would say it just to annoy us. And it's after we got it, then it was just like more like, "Oh, like, you know, this is serious," because, you know, he's a high school kid. He was getting ready to graduate. It was just a big joke. Like, what is this COVID thing? What is, you know, these people are crazy. They're not, you know, this isn't making any sense. But I think that once we got it, he, it really hit home for him. And I, you know, they both were very fearful of what could happen to us. But I think with us recovering from it, them here, you know, it helped them to see that you can survive this. However, I think that they met, or just even seeing on the news, they saw a lot of people, even from here, or even in Jamaica or other countries, everybody knows someone who has had it. And so, you know, I think that for them, it's not the same for us, because they're operating from a side of youth, right? They're thinking like, no, we're going to be fine. Or, you know, none of our peers passed away from it, but they've heard of, you know, people in their 40s who passed away or 50s and things like that. So I think there's still some level of disconnect. You know,
what happened with your son's high school graduation?
So our son, actually, this was in May of 2020. And so this school, you know, this is supposed to be a big thing, you know, May 2020, the big graduation. Nope. So he didn't have a prom. and he didn't. They had like all these different meetings and to try to figure out what parents felt comfortable with doing. They, thank goodness the weather was good, so they had a graduation, but they had it where it was outside on the field and like you'd on a track field. And so they had people like there was so much distance. I think it was awesome though. They had like different, you know, there was so much distance with you coming up to the podium. I mean, it was just open, like an open field of kids graduating. So that worked out well. They did, which I thought was nice, as I'm jousting my memory. They had like a path, like for, cause we all live in like this neighborhood. And so they all drove through the fire department with the trucks and the, you know, they had like all the teachers, you know, it was like a car line just driving through different towns, through different neighborhoods, honking the horn and celebrating. And, you know, and while the kids, stood at the, you know, at the gates, of their house, like they'd say, be ready at 2 o'clock. We're going to be coming through your subdivision at that time. And so that was really nice. You know, you'd have your cap and gown on, they're waving at you, and, you know, you have the fire department honking the horn and the sirens going off. So that was kind of cool. You know, kids are out their windows. Like, it was nice. So, yeah. Yeah.
How are you feeling about the immediate future?
Just bear with me for a minute. My immediate future... when you talk about safety, like I don't, or just like, I feel good in the sense of, you know, I'm the immediate future, meaning like a month or, you know, just that I'm excited because it's been, the weather's nice here in New York. It's nice and hot, which is great. So I'm excited about that. I'm excited about, you know, my daughter being a senior in high school, this, you know, officially a senior this year. I'm excited about my husband and I celebrating another anniversary. I'm excited about, you know, in a month I'll be going back home to Jamaica just to kind of pay my respect to family members and friends who passed away, childhood friends who passed away from the pandemic and some that weren't due to the pandemic, but just to go back home and just to be, you know, on the land that I was born, in the land that I was born, I feel like as if it's been like really overdue, and I want to just like walk the streets in the little towns where I grew up, and just, you know, I'm just very grateful for all of that. So I'm looking forward to that. As far as work, I think that, you know, work is busy, but I'm grateful for today and what will come, you know, post today, God willing. And, you know, there's this work. It's a lot of work, and I'm, you know, it's a sad situation, but I'm also grateful that I'm here to support people, and I feel hopeful. Yeah, I feel hopeful about the future in respects to what I, you know, to the immediate future, with myself, my family. We just hope. I feel hopeful. It's all we have.
What are some of your hopes for a longer term future?
Again, I'd have to go back to health. I think, of course, you wish you had more money or more, you know, being able to like go on like, you know, these trips. I think, because of COVID, I think that a lot of people really step back, as in myself, even though it's not like on a macro level, right? Like, I think that with COVID, just stepping back and really reassessing what is important to us. I think that's what one of the things that COVID did for us. But I think for now, and, you know, I hope that I'll be able to just be healthy, to live and to be able to work and not be touched by some of these things that we talked about, whether it's violence, whether it's cancer, whether it's just sadness and sorrow. Like, we all have, it's a season for all of this, but I think that, I just hope that I can continue to be healthy and to be able to do some of those things that you know, like travel and being more with our kids, you know, to do more things with our children as they are at, you know, as they're getting older with my family. So those are the things that I'm hopeful about, and just being able to help other, you know, help more people in the capacity that I'm in now. Or so I'm looking forward to that, you know, schooling, education, what, you know, what will be the next step, just trying to figure all of that out. So the main thing is just hoping for health. So, because with health, then I could be able to do all of that and a little money too. But like with health, you know, just I'll be able to be able to do that.
Do you think of COVID-19 as an event, as a historical moment?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
What would you want people in the humanities and the social sciences to be studying right now so that we could understand the human side of this experience?
I was going to say, not only did, because I said before, COVID not, it kind of leveled the playing field, but it also showed us that, well, you know what, it doesn't. It leveled the field to a certain level, but it also showed me as a Black woman, equity was always in my mind or on my tongue, just always talking about it. I think that COVID opened up opportunities for people who, you know, for people who didn't really think or see it, and now they're able to see the correlation to all of that. So my goal is that people continue to see the correlation between all of these things, you know, these barriers, these institutionalized things that are set up to oppress and to discriminate against people. And I know that it's hard for not only people of color, but also people outside of that, you know, to acknowledge and to accept that. So I hope that people will continue to learn more, not only about these institutions and these societal barriers that lead to inequality and equity, but also to really dig deep within themselves and try to figure out how can they help others. I think the other thing too with COVID is that it showed us that we're not, like, you know, people always say like, oh yeah, like that has nothing to do with me. This happened in China. This happened in Africa. This happened here. And it's like, no, like we're all globally connected. You know, we're not just here and it doesn't affect us. So I think that people continue to not only find ways to learn more about themselves, learn more about others. It's definitely a teachable moment, not only for ourselves, but for our children, for our families, and just to continue to do more studies. I think for myself, even to like wanting to look and to see like, why are these things this way, and how can we help to kind of close some of those gaps in whatever areas we're in. We don't have to be even in the social sciences. I think that it really is about, with all the racism and all the different things that came from COVID that opened up our eyes, we really should be very cognizant of what role we play and what can we do to better ourselves, how we can treat our neighbors, even if we don't agree with them. Like, you know, like what are some of these things that we can support others with? The thing that comes to mind is just like, you know, cultural humility, like always learning about, whether you're in social sciences or not, or in the healthcare industry or whatever, like just to try to be a learner, always learning and looking for opportunities to learn more about yourself and others.
I'd like you to imagine talking to a historian in the future, someone far enough away that they have no lived experience of this moment. Attentive to like how easy it is to leave all of these gaps in history, what would you tell this historian cannot be forgotten about this moment?
Goodness. I think what can't be forgotten about this moment, I think, is just the many black faces. The only thing I can think of is George Floyd, and there's so many things happened during the pandemic, but that's one of the things that stood out to me, you know, May 25th, 2020, you know, seeing that video that can't be omitted, that can't be erased, that can't be rewritten, or be written with pleasantries or to, you know, I think that that's something that will forever go down in history as a day of, you know, mourning, grief, anger. And that just, it's just spread, you know, so just, it was literally a global reckoning seeing that. So yeah, that would be the main thing from 2020. I mean, yeah.
I want to thank you so very much for the generosity of your time and your answers. Those are all of the questions I know how to ask right now. But if there's anything you'd like to say that my questions haven't made room for, please take some space and say so.
No, it was an honor to be able to speak, and I hope that others will learn or to and be willing to share their stories. I thank you for the opportunity. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.